the terror weapons of the naval war of 1812. And by that, I mean mines and torpedoes and submarines. And to quote the law, any other destructive machine whatsoever to destroy a British warship. And this basically legalized a form of what we might today possibly consider terrorism on the behalf of American citizens against the British. It certainly encouraged the civilian population to go sink by whatever means possible they could a British warship. And then they got to reclaim half the value of that ship. And with me to discuss it, I have Andrew Fagel, who is a arms and military technology historian of the early United States and also the associate editor of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson at Princeton. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Chase. Great to be here.
So you wrote this really interesting paper, which is The Terror Weapons of the Naval War of 1812. And when I'm reading this, it really seems like the genesis of this is this political fight in between the Federalists and the Jeffersonians, the Republicans, on how we are going to fund a Navy. Are we going to have a big sort of standing Navy, which is going to be able to go toe-to-toe with the British, which we sort of do, right? We built some good frigates and they have some early success. Or are we going to try and cheap out and then have to figure it out after the fact?
Yeah, I mean, underwater mines had been around going back to the 1500s. And Robert Fulton, who is a inventor and innovator, he's over in France and England during the Napoleonic Wars, and his real passion is naval technology. So even if we know Fulton from the fact that he built the first commercial steamship in American history, which is probably his most important contribution, is that he's really all about finding new and better ways to make things explode. The French are not interested in his ideas. He starts showing the submarine to Napoleon. They're not that interested. Goes over to Britain, working on these underwater mines. There's a failed attack against Boulogne, 1804. He has a demonstration in Britain of how he can actually blow up a brig with these underwater mines. The British are suitably impressed, but not enough to go much further with this technology, especially after the naval victory at Trafalgar. So he comes home to the United States. He starts talking to Jefferson about his technology in early 1807. Doesn't really go much places until the Chesapeake Leopard affair later that year, when a British frigate stops an American frigate saying there's British sailors on board. We're going to impress them back into our Navy. And in doing so, they open fire on the American frigate. And this creates a big international incident that over the course of the next 5 years leads to war with the United States, with the War of 1812, to redress a lot of these grievances. So as part of all of this is that Fulton is offering a cheap solution to the problems of Britain's naval superiority, is that for a mere $84, you can build a mine.
A steal. And
it's a steal compared to however many hundreds of thousands of dollars you would spend a year on a frigate or a 74-gun ship of the line. You can blow one of those things up for $84. And there is immense interest in the United States in using Fulton's mines to protect American ports and harbors against the British Royal Navy. So New York City actually mines its harbor during the War of 1812. And there are attempts to use these mines on British warships in the Chesapeake Bay and in Long Island Sound.
And so these mines and these other inventive explosive devices that the Congress is trying to incentivize Americans to whip up,
yep,
is basically an asymmetric threat, sort of in the line of what in the news the Houthis are doing, right? They're lobbing cheap missiles and drones to, yeah, keep tens of billions of dollars of warships tied up and dealing with it, because they certainly don't have the resources to go toe-to-toe with the United States Navy and whatever other navies are in the area, just like the United States Navy was in absolutely no position whatsoever to go toe-to-toe on a sustained basis with the Royal Navy.
Right. No, absolutely. So what's going on is there's so much interest in these torpedoes and alternate ways of fighting is that Congress decides to pass legislation basically incentivizing Americans to go out and do it yourselves. Like, we're not necessarily going to use these measures in our own Navy. They will in you know, Fulton's steamship, Fulton the First. But for these mines, if you want it, we will incentivize you by, we will pay out half the value of any British warship that's destroyed using a mine or any other destructive device.
Which is more than the average person would make in their entire lifetime by a huge margin.
By absolutely. And, you know, there had always been private incentive in naval warfare going back centuries. So I'm thinking about privateering here. And the question is this similar to or different from privateering? And I think it's similar in the sense that it's private parties getting involved, but I think it's very different from an economic and legal perspective, where in a privateering voyage, you have to get a letter of marque and reprisal effectively from a country saying you are legally able to take prizes on behalf of the United States of America. Otherwise, what you're doing is piracy, and no nation respects piracy. But there's also the sense of you target the merchant ship, you bring the merchant ship back to your home port. There is a legal case to decide whether or not the capture of this merchant ship was all on the up and up. And if it's found legally that it's all on the up and up, it's only then that you get to sell those goods at auction. And your profit is determined by what's bought and sold at the marketplace. So if you capture a ship full of gold, awesome. If you capture a ship full of beef jerky, not so much. But with the law specifying half the value of one of these British warships, that's a lot of money. But for the British, they don't necessarily respect a private citizen going up and trying to blow up one of those ships. That's, from their perspective, that's piracy. They're not legal combatants from the fight. So exactly, like, you know, the Houthis are, you know, well, at one point in time, they were
rebels slash government. Yeah, they, you know, they're terrorists, but they are terrorists who control a state. So, you know, TBD.
Right. Right. And so, you know, from the British perspective is that, yeah, like the, one of these guys, Joshua Penny, who is involved in trying to set out some of these naval mines in Long Island Sound, they actually row up and capture him while he's asleep, and they send him off to prison back in Britain. And there's a question as to whether or not he actually had a commission in the U.S. Navy that was kind of like given to him on the down low to say like, oh, no, you're actually a naval officer in case you're captured. I don't know. I don't know all the specifics behind that. But yeah, it's very much like they will. The British naval officers are not happy with this state of affairs. And also, it's not just these underwater mines, which are essentially kegs of gunpowder with a clockwork mechanism set to make them explode, is that the Americans are inventive enough that they start making decoy ships with a hold full of gunpowder and turpentine and other flammable items, with the idea, in this one case from a schooner called the Eagle that set sail in 1813, with the idea that, look, if you put enough foodstuffs on board, the British are going to think that this is a supply vessel. Everything that a ship on blockade duty is going to want to feed their crew, they'll pull it in, they'll pull it next to the ship, they'll start unloading the goods, and then once they spring the tripwire, the whole thing explodes. And this probably would have been the most effective one of these explosive devices that would have been used during the war, except for the fact that it's in the initial search phase when the British ship's barge is out investigating, why is there this American schooner sailing towards us that the crew was all just abandoned, that they go into the hold and it explodes and it kills 11 sailors. So, you know, you can understand from the British perspective, like, this is an ungentlemanly way to fight. It is an illegal way to fight. Anyone doing so is involved in piracy. Whereas for the Americans to fit out the vessel, these ships are blockading our harbor. We can't import, you know, we can't bring in foodstuffs and other items. Also, it's a lot of money.
Right. Mix of financial incentive and patriotism will make people get real inventive, we'll say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so has international law at this point even evolved a concept for this? Because unlike privateers, and privateers had been around for centuries, and they had a degree of legal protection under international law because you had that letter of marque and reprisal, and you know, had a defined set of targets that you could go after. But now that private citizens had that incentive, and they may have had a little on down low commission, but by and large, they didn't, and they were recognized as not having that. It really blurs the lines between who is a legal combatant,
right?
Between who is a legal combatant and who is not. And therefore, that also blurs the lines of who we can go and attack as a enemy combatant and who isn't.
Right.
And so the Royal Navy responds, you know, sort of interestingly to this, right?
Yeah. And so the idea of a legal combatant has been around for up to 100 years by this point, where you start getting soldiers wearing uniforms in late 1600s, early 1700s, as a way to distinguish who is a combatant and who isn't. And if you're not in uniform, you can be treated as a spy or as a civilian non-combatant. So if you're shooting at someone and you're not in uniform, you can be summarily executed. So think about the case of John Andre, who had stolen the plans to West Point during the American Revolution. Had Andre been in uniform when he was captured, he would not have been executed. But because he changed into civilian clothing prior to being captured, he was treated as a spy and killed. And so the British, they think that if communities are sending out individuals with bombs to blow up their ships, that makes those communities a valid target for reprisal. So
was that a generally accepted aspect of international law? Because today that would not be, right? If there's a right. You know, small village and they go send out a little pirate skiff and it, you know, does some piracy, right? You know, shoots at an American warship, right? We're not going to launch a couple of missiles and just destroy the town marketplace and whoever happens to be there.
Right.
So, but yeah, was that acceptable international law? You know, was it even defined back then?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it was defined, but I would say it was both acceptable and common practice, at least among the British. You know, there's that question of to what extent are they targeting military targets, or if a city decides to resist an attack, can the entire city, you know, is it liable for looting and basically being put to the sword? And because the way sieges had worked for generations prior is that if the city surrenders, that's it. So you cannot loot it, you cannot pillage it. But if you have to go over the walls, anything can happen. And, you know, there's this kind of long transition of what happens in that type of combat. So the thing that the British naval officers do on the coast of America is that they say, you know, any villages that are involved in like outfitting people who are going to set out these mines, we will attack them. And there is an incident in the War of 1812 where the British Navy bombards the town of Stonington, Connecticut. Now, are they doing this as an example to all other towns along Long Island Sound? You know, the people in Stonington claim, we're not sending out any people in rowboats with these naval mines to attack your ships.
As one would if they had done so.
You know, or is this the case of Commodore Hardy, who's in command of the ships at this point? Is he mistaken in what the source of these attacks is? Or are the attacks coming down the Connecticut River through New London? And, you know, well, we can't get to New London, so we'll make an example of this other town. I'm not certain. One historian who's written about the Battle of Stonington says they are intentionally missing the town with their cannon fire because Stonington was not destroyed. I don't think there was any civilian casualties. So is this just a matter of we're going to put out a show of force to try to disincentivize these attacks. But there are British authors at the time who justify and explain the burning of Washington, D.C. as part of this is retribution for these torpedo attacks against our vessels on the coast. So, you know, it's the tit for tat there. If you come at us with a torpedo, we're going to do something a little bit worse to you. So
in this war, despite the financial incentive, it creates some terror among the British, but ultimately not much destruction to go along with the terror. No. And it wouldn't be until really the Civil War in American naval history that the concept of mines and torpedoes reaches fruition, and then continuing through probably its greatest use in history thus far in World War II, where the torpedo turns out to be a very cost-effective solution to sink a big old battleship.
Oh, yeah.
Or an aircraft carrier or merchant shipping en masse, right? And so, yeah, this was the very first bit. But I thought this was an interesting episode, especially now, given the blurred international lines, you know, combined with naval conflict and what's happening in the Red Sea right now with the Houthis off the coast of Yemen and the Suez Canal. And so I just thought this was a interesting discussion about how current events now tie into American history. The role is a bit reversed, though.
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote the article in 2013, the big thing in the news at the time was improvised explosive devices on land in Iraq during the Iraq War. And so that was something, it was always on my mind, but when I did the research and did the writing, it's like, this is the topic that they're looking at, but it's amazing the ways in which these kinds of asymmetrical warfare resonate across the decades, and will continue to do so.
No doubt they will continue to do so for a long time. I think we're at a little bit of an inflection point where asymmetrical has gained a little bit of the advantage while states play a little bit of catch up. But I think the pendulum is just now starting to swing back as big states, you know, the United States, China, Russia, et cetera, are starting to develop some electronic countermeasures that are really effective against drone warfare and such. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next, you know, decade, right, and how, yeah, the symmetric and asymmetric forces balance out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have this source at the time I wrote that article, but subsequently, I found a letter from one of the British naval captains who was present at Robert Fulton's demonstrations in Britain in 1805, where he blew up a brig with one of these mines, where he's warning the British admiral in charge of the American station, who's in Halifax, that look, these mines can work. They can do real damage to our ships, but there are ways to defeat them. You got to put up a net. And as long as you have a net up, that's going to stop the torpedo attacks. The downside is it takes time to put up a net. Once the net is in place, you're not as maneuverable as a ship anymore. So there are some cons. It does change British behavior during the War of 1812, just from like a tactical standpoint. But it's, as you said, you know, once the state actors start thinking about countermeasures to this technology, it's like, well, there's a few things we can do, and we can pretty much negate that. So it's usually a little bit scary at first, but there are ways around it.
So far, at least.
yeah, so far.
So thank you very much, Andrew. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'm going to put a link to your paper here in the show notes for anyone who wants to go and read in a lot more detail on the American terror weapons. And then the British response to it, burning, you know, laying waste to a bit of the seaside towns of New England. And I'd appreciate if you're listening, if you could tell any friends or family or anyone else that you know who might enjoy this podcast. I love seeing the numbers go up. It's that little bit of internal validation I get that makes this whole thing worth it. Give me 5 stars, leave me a review. I would really appreciate it. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.